but each state has to meet minimal federal standards first. Under the Republican budget, Uncle Sam would cut the check to states, but it would require nothing in return. Republicans say it's a states' rights issue. Democrats like Congressperson Tim Ryan of Ohio say you need a federal minimum for the program, otherwise some states will throw people with disabilities and the poor off their Medicaid rolls.
We all know we have a debt problem, but there is a way to get there, and to do it on the backs of the Medicaid recipients and those people in early childhood care. These things are going to go to our ability to compete globally.
Then there are the tax changes. Besides cutting hundreds of billions of dollars from non-defense spending over the next decade, the budget also drops the highest individual tax rate from 35% to 25%. Coupled with the sweeping changes to Medicare and Medicaid, Democrats argue the bill amounts to a grab bag for the rich. Here's how Kent Conrad, the Democratic head of the Senate Budget Committee, describes the GOP budget.
It lacks balance. There's these deep tax cuts for those who are the wealthiest among us, and then to pay for that, just draconian cuts.
Republicans admit attempting to tackle entitlements is politically risky, but they argue the mounting federal debt makes their effort a necessity. Democrats are expected to offer their counter-budget next week. Going into a presidential election year, these competing documents will be fodder for ads and could define the national debate on spending. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.
Time is just about 7 p.m. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, and it's about time for another edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Very good evening to you. The show is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you. I'm joined in the studio by Mike.
Hello.
And Voltaire.
Ooh, yeah, cash out.
And Jim is here.
Hello.
On the phone, we have Bernie S. in Philadelphia. Are you there, Bernie S. in Philadelphia?
I'm here. Greetings from Philadelphia.
And who we don't have here is Emmanuel, who's running late. So
he's supposed to be on the phone. Are you there, Emmanuel?
Yeah, I'm here on the phone. I'm also, I just got on the FDR Drive. Boy, what a hassle it's been getting into the city today. Apparently, I just found out that Obama's in town, and that means all kinds of roads are closed. But the thing is, there's no communication. They don't tell you what roads are closed. Cops direct you to the FDR Drive, and when you get there, you find out that it's barricaded, and you have to turn around and go back. There was nothing about this on the radio to guide cars away. But within the last 45 seconds, I was able to break through a police barrier, get onto the FDR Drive, and I'm speeding downtown right now to Wall Street, and I hope to be there fairly soon. How are you guys?
We're well, I think. I don't want to speak for everyone, but, you know, those of us who can make it here, even when the president's in town, seem to be doing well.
Well, I'm going to hand the phone over to Kyle so that I can continue driving safely and not get caught talking on the phone. Here, one moment.
It's worth knowing that...
Hello?
Hello, Kyle.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. Voltaire, you were saying something?
Yes, Obama's only in town for 3 hours, but he's that's long enough to cause a lot of commotion.
Cause commotion everywhere he goes. Did you see this news from Holland? Our friend Rob has been making some waves, I guess, because one of the members of the Dutch parliament asked the foreign affairs minister, whose name is Uri Rosenthal, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, a bunch of questions, basically, about Rob's case, about the whole Twitter fiasco and where the U.S. government is trying to get all this information. And one of the things they asked they asked the foreign minister, do you agree that the Netherlands will not cooperate with criminal procedures of the American authorities, such as in the case of potential suspects connected to WikiLeaks? If not, why not? And the answer was basically, well, no, we're not going to promise anything. If the U.S. government asks, well, we have an extradition treaty with them, then I guess we might follow it. And this caused all kinds of furor in the Netherlands, which is good. I'm glad that things like that can cause furor in some parts of the world. You know, because most people there believe, apparently, or at least a lot of people believe, that Rob has not done anything wrong and maybe he shouldn't be sent to the U.S. But the key thing that Rob has posted on his blog to explain is that there is, in fact, no extradition request at the current time. So he's safe for now. And, the Dutch media storm notwithstanding. I don't know. What do you think, Bernie?
Well, I think extraditing anyone for something as simple as sharing information is ridiculous. We'll see. I wish the United States didn't seem to have a stranglehold on so many other governments as far as getting them to extradite people to the United States. It seems to be a one-way street. A lot of other countries have people like in the United States who are accused of being war criminals, and yet they'll never go to those countries. So it's a double standard, I think.
Hey, Josh, can I break in here for a moment? I just want to report that I'm driving down the FDR Drive. And Obama has just taken off in a helicopter. There's actually two helicopters that are flying over Brooklyn right now. And this just happened. Apparently, I'm like right behind him. I'm getting off FDR now, so I should be in the studio in a couple of minutes. But the whole downtown is being barricaded off as a result of this.
Yeah, I believe those are the two helicopters that Jim pointed out to me earlier that we can actually see at the helipad from the window of the station here. And, yeah, there's the typical amount of presidential commotion.
There's an incredible amount of police activity down here, vans and trucks and fire trucks, people with those long overcoats, and wow, it's something to see.
I have to say, though, that there's so many police and construction and whatnot going on around here every week that I came down by bicycle, and I was almost all the way here before I realized, you know, I even detected that it was higher than normal, the police insanity.
What is normal for downtown rush hour?
I don't know.
Which of the helicopters was the cop? Was the one with the president, and which was the decoy? I want to know.
I don't know, but I left my laser pointer at home, so I couldn't aggravate them at all.
I just noticed that they weren't the presidential helicopters. I think they're the ones with two props, I forget what they're called, but they seem maybe like more of his entourage. I think maybe he left a little bit earlier, but it definitely looks like things are winding down, and it's going to get less crazy downtown shortly.
But even his entourage gets helicopters?
Yeah, I think they do. They're like these military ones with the two props, and I didn't see any of the ones that were green and white, so he must be long gone by now.
All right.
Oh, these are the ones that have each one have two props on them. They're like big they look like a big freight carrier on
right.
Okay.
Right. I can't remember the name.
They're
not Huey's, are they?
They load these things up with vehicles, like the presidential limousine and all the other stuff they load on
right.
the helicopters, and they roll them off.
Right, right.
Wow.
Yeah, it seems like that's exactly what's going on, is the last of the equipment and personnel are taking off, and the New York, police officers on motorcycles and all the aid vehicles just sort of standing around looking like they're, you know, done for the day. That's about it. I think we're pulling up here, so...
The advantage of getting here after 7 is that the parking is free, so at least I can have that to point to. I'll be up in a couple of minutes, though. We'll see you then.
Okay, so if we want to do anything terrible to your chair, we have to do it now.
You got the knife, right?
I got it, yeah. All right. And the chewing gum.
That's good. We have this announcement from the folks at the OpenAMD project. OpenAMD, folks will remember, has been at the past couple of Hopes, and what they make is badges that basically follow you all around the conference and show where everyone is and where they're going and what they're thinking and, I don't know, all kinds of things. And they're trying to build a similar system at the Chaos Camp this summer in Germany, but that conference is not able to fund the project, so they're looking for community support to build it. So you can go to their website, which is openamd.org/Kickstarter, and they'll have more information there about how you can support the project.
Always a lot of fun. We always enjoy the OpenAMD shenanigans at our conferences, don't we? Yes, Walter.
In other announcement news, tomorrow there's going to be our friends are anonymous are throwing a rally to support Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks at 3 p.m. at City Hall in Manhattan. So you should all go to that.
An anonymous rally.
Where is that again?
In City Hall.
Is there
in New York?
Is there a website for that? Or
no, there's a press release and a.
It shouldn't be too hard to find, knowing that crowd. So
it's just the official name for the rally is the Rally for Information Freedom. So if you just Google that, the top search results should be like the Village Voice talking about the event. It looks really good.
Well, if you read it in the Village Voice, it must be true. So
definitely.
Bernie, I think you had some news as well.
Well, we set the stage last week. We were talking about social engineering attacks on average people, and it appears that there's a lot of these companies you do business with online will establish an online relationship with you and get your email address. And
they're
your name
they're spamming me, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, a lot of companies do that, but they also are don't even bother to manage these mailing lists themselves. They farm them out to big companies like a company called Epsilon, and it looks like dozens and dozens of companies who all use this company called Epsilon to manage their mailing lists got hacked in a bad way, and or basically Epsilon failed to protect these mailing lists. And now it looks like tens of millions of Americans, or at least many millions of Americans, names and email addresses are in the hands of unauthorized people. And not only do they know your name and address, that now they know what company you did business with, which makes it a little easier to social engineer people. If you can send a fake email, if these crooks can send any one of these millions of victims now an email pretending to be from the company they did business with, using your name and an email address, and say, "Oh, we need your account information again. We lost it." So this has all been over the mainstream media the past few days. But we were talking about this very topic last week, and it's just it just goes to show you really need to keep your guard up. And we here on Off the Hook, we've even gotten some of these attempts. Just the past week, haven't we?
Yeah, apparently Off the Hook bought flowers for someone. I didn't know that. But we got an email saying that the flowers people had their database taken. I also got one from Chase, which is a bank that I do business with, and a couple more. They're really – apparently like a lot of really big companies were Epsilon's clients. And it's not clear, though, what the risk from this disclosure is.
Well, I like how all these companies, when they say that your information was compromised, they all say something like, and I'm going to quote the one from 1-800-Flowers. They say, quote, "We take your privacy very seriously, and we work diligently to ensure your private information is always protected." Obviously, they don't.
Well, no, Bernie, you're wrong on that because they do. By the way, I'm here in the studio. I made it upstairs.
Welcome. Good to see you.
You know, Obama's really starting to piss me off. That's all I got to say. He's supposed to let us know when he's in town. And, wow, I can't get anywhere. And there are other issues, too. Take my First Amendment rights, take away various liberties, and kowtow to Republicans, fine. But don't mess with the traffic, you know? Anyway, Bernie, they do take your privacy seriously. Seriously, they have taken your privacy. I mean, that's what they mean.
Okay.
You got to read between the lines.
All right.
It just seems that the only thing bad that can happen because of this is I'll get more spam, and that's bad, but hardly novel.
I've been seeing all kinds of notices from various companies, Chase, 1-800-Flowers, a couple of others, saying that something happened to their mailing list at Epsilon. Never heard of Epsilon before. Didn't know what everybody used a company to store a mailing list. Why can't they store it themselves? Why do they have to farm it out to a third party?
Well, it might get broken into if you don't do it right.
Yeah.
Well, it's obviously a very trustworthy third party that you can depend on to keep your information safe.
Yeah.
Well, did I say is? I meant isn't.
You put everything in one area, one company, and look what happens.
Hey, every admin loves a single point of failure.
Yes. I missed the first part of what you guys were talking about as far as Epsilon, the Epsilon breach, but...
We were calling you names.
Have there been more developments? Anything else?
There have just been... We've gotten emails from quite a few listeners who, from different companies, have forwarded us similar-looking emails of apology and... informing them of the breach. And some companies are, I think, a little more proactive at this than others.
Well, I think it's another reason why you don't give out your email address unless you really have to give out your email address. But most times you don't really have to do that.
But, I mean, I don't mind my bank having my email address. I like them to email me when my statement is ready.
Why can't they just... email you when your statement is ready? Why can't they just... you can check, I suppose.
Have to go there every day to check? No.
Okay, so you're one of these people that doesn't get a paper statement in the mail.
A what?
Okay, you know, this is why paper statements... Well, another reason why paper statements are a good idea, because for one thing, and I've seen this with credit cards, credit card companies are always trying to get you to cut out the paper statement and go green. That's what they tell you, that you're going green. And okay, so when do they pass those savings on to the consumer? They never actually do, and they keep sending you junk mail anyway. But the point is, if you get the actual thing in the mail, you can hold on to it for as long as you want. Try going back 5 years on any credit card company, and it's virtually impossible.
So what I do is I download the statement to my hard drive, and I keep it there. And I'm much less likely to lose my hard drive than I am like one piece of paper.
Well, I don't know about that. I've seen plenty of hard drives go. Hopefully you back it up. If you back it up, okay, I'll agree with you. But if you're not backing it up, that hard drive's going to go a long time before my drawer with all my receipts going back for 20 years.
You have 20 years worth of receipts in one drawer?
You know, I like to keep track of things.
How do you keep track of things if they're all in one drawer?
Well, I know where they are.
All right.
It's a big drawer.
You must be better at this than I am.
Kyle, you made it.
Yes, I made it.
Wow. Well, you were in the same car as me. I'm not surprised you made it, but I ran faster than you.
Yes, you did. You beat me up the stairs. I just wanted to comment about what you guys were just talking about as far as bills. I have friends who specifically with the phone company, they prefer the paper bill because they know it forces them to actually print something and that costs them money, whereas the electronic bills – they know it's simply processing. It's not actually resources. They don't have to buy paper and pay a printer to actually come up with it or print it internally. So it's kind of funny. People actually prefer to make them do the work as far as producing a document that they can then keep in their files if mm-hmm. something comes up with their bill.
Yeah. I pay electronically. I do that. I don't write checks and mail checks. Although, talking about waste of paper and waste of resources, a couple of weeks ago coming down here on the good old MTA, I get it from all ends. It's either on the road, yeah, Jim, you know, or it's with mass transit. But I tried to use my card in the subway, and it only had a dollar on it. But worse than that, it was expired. And that's the thing with Metro cards. You never know how much is on them when you find them in your pocket. So you have to go and experiment and try it. And I found out that not only did it not have enough for a fare, but it was expired. So I went to the booth to talk to the human, which is something you don't get to do all that often because machines do everything these days. And I said, can you transfer this onto another Metro card? And no, they can't do that. They can't transfer $1 from an expired MetroCard onto a non-expired MetroCard. I don't understand why not. Obviously, it's there. Obviously, you paid for it. They just can't do this. What she did instead was she handed me a postage-paid envelope that I'm supposed to put the card in, mail it to the MTA, then they're going to mail me a dollar in the mail. How much have they spent already to mail me a dollar? And how much paper has been wasted when all they have to do is transfer from one card to another, or maybe not have the things expire, or God forbid, tell you how much is on them, like they do in Washington, D.C., so you can actually look and see how much is on your card. These are things that were not thought through.
And on a related note, on the Long Island Railroad, which I take, the tickets now that you buy are only good for 2 weeks. If they expire after those 2 weeks, you can't get a refund. There is a $10 refund fee on a ticket which cost me less than $10.
Voltaire, you were telling me this a couple of weeks ago about Metro North, which is the sister organization of Long Island Railroad. And I remember the train tickets being good for at least 6 months.
A year or two ago.
How does a ticket expire after 2 weeks? What is it in their minds that makes them say this is no good anymore?
It lets them keep more money.
Well, obviously it's that, but how did we let them get away with that? it's so clearly an evil plot.
Well, I mean, the answer is because the state government declines to fund the MTA, so they have to resort to all these shenanigans to raise money without appearing to raise the fare.
I don't know. Armed robbery, I think, would be more moralistic than this. But, wow, I can't believe it.
You can write the MTA a letter suggesting they branch out into the armed robbery business, and maybe they'll take you up on it.
Yeah. Or write the state government.
Well, just another reason not to take mass transit. The cost, the rip-offness, the slowness. It's really pretty unbelievable. Okay, have we talked about this latest net neutrality court decision on Monday?
We have not.
Okay. Well, maybe somebody can explain it to me then. This is what I've seen. A federal appeals court on Monday rejected as premature a lawsuit by Verizon and MetroPCS that challenged the FCC's pending rules aimed at keeping internet service providers from blocking access to certain websites or applications. You know, I try to follow these things, but that sentence makes my head swim. Is this good? Is this bad? What is it?
It's good. It's but good. It's not in a great way. It's just a legal technicality that says that they filed the paperwork too soon because the FCC hasn't even...
Who filed the paperwork too soon?
Verizon.
And Verizon's, they're the bad guys in this, right?
Yeah. Okay. As in most things, yeah.
All right. Federal Appeals Court basically told them that they filed something too soon.
Yeah, so they're going to file it again in a month or so after the FCC actually publishes
So it really doesn't mean anything then?
Yeah. I don't know why it does.
Bernie, what does it mean?
The panel of judges said, quote, the Verizon's prematurity is incurable. So,
is that really what he said?
I don't know if it was a medical condition. They said that their prematurity was incurable, but I thought it was a funny thing coming from judges to say that. But basically, what it means is that Verizon's motion to have this have something decided in their favor, which was at least temporarily shot down. So it's good news for people who are in favor of net neutrality. It's not a final decision yet, but at least it keeps the ball in the game, and we'll see where this goes. I'm convinced this is going to go to the Supreme Court eventually, whether the FCC will indeed be found to have the authority to mandate that Internet service providers not selectively move traffic around and slow things down when you want to go to one website versus another, throttle you, limit your bandwidth, that sort of thing. So we'll see where it goes. But the ball is still in the game, and that's a good thing.
Now, Bernie, if I understand correctly, this rule is not even full net neutrality like many of us have been arguing for. This is the sort of limited, wishy-washy version that the FCC proposed, which in particular does not apply to mobile and wireless carriers at all.
Exactly. It was a real trade-off that the FCC took, because I think they just found that the mobile telephony providers were just too powerful a lobby, I think, for them to fight it all off. So the argument that the mobile carriers made was that we have to be able to throttle traffic and block traffic, whatever, because we have a limited amount of bandwidth over the airwaves as opposed to the wired traffic, which is much greater bandwidth. But I think that it should have been net neutrality across the board. But doesn't look like the Obama administration is even pushing for that for mobile carriers now.
Well, if he's listening on the helicopter, maybe this could be made a priority. Here's a story. This is something that I thought was just simply brilliant, involving Condé Nast. Am I saying that right?
Condé Nast.
Condé Nast. That's how you're supposed to say it? Okay.
Oui.
All right, fine. Condé Nast. Those are the folks who own Wired, right?
And every other magazine.
Well, not 2600 magazine. They don't own
Is that thing still publishing?
Own us? Yeah, I think so.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure we're still publishing. Technical. In fact, we just put out an issue, but I'll get to that in a second. This is something that is indicative of how easy it is to scam a big company out of millions of dollars. You can just send a single email pretending to be a vendor of that company. That's apparently, and this comes from techdirt.com, that's apparently what a guy named Andy Surface, that's really his name, Andy Surface, discovered when he set up a bank account for an operation he called QuadGraph, likely designed to be similar to Quad Graphics, the giant printing company that prints many big-name magazines. He then sent a single email to magazine giant Condé Nast, leading the magazine company to send that new account $8 million. In early November, Condé Nast received an electronic payment authorization form by email at its offices in New York. The form appeared to have been sent by Quad Graphics. The form requested that Condé Nast direct payments for Quad Graphics to the Quad Graph account and provided account information. They then filled out the form and returned it by fax from its offices in New York to the fax number provided in that form. Following the receipt of the electronic payment authorization form, they then started making payments for Quad Graphics bills by ACH transfer from J.P. Morgan Chase Bank in New York to this Quad Graph account. The whole thing was discovered when the actual printer noticed that it was no longer getting paid, and they asked Condé Nast what was up. They then went to the feds, who arrested the guy and amazingly discovered that all $8 million was still sitting in the bank account. You know, if it was me, I think I would just let it sit there too, because I'd be too amazed that this actually worked.
$8 million?
$8 million, just like that. And we get all the time. We get people sending bills for some kind of directory listing or some nonsensical service that doesn't really exist. And if you're stupid or bureaucratic, you'll just write a check or send in an authorization form, and then you get ripped off.
So the headline's a bit misleading, because it sounds like there's one email and, in addition, one fax. So it's not just one email.
Well, there was an email, I think, requesting that they do this.
And, right, and then was a fax.
Then they faxed to him.
The fax came from Condé. The fax was the reply.
Right.
The email directed Condé Nast to print a form and fill it out and fax that to the purported printing company, which it wasn't the real printing company.
Okay, so what exactly is the crime here? I mean, is it illegal to send an email asking someone to fill out a form? Because that's really, isn't that all they did? They filled out a form and they faxed it. But the actual transfer, they did that themselves. The bank did that themselves. Someone just sent, and if he sent it on April 1st, then I think he's really got a good case.
So, I mean, if I send you a form, and you don't owe me any money, but I send you a form authorizing you to make payments into my account, mm-hmm. is that illegal?
I don't think it's illegal to send anybody a form.
I'll fill out the form. I'll even give you my bank account number, uh-huh. as long as we can encrypt it.
Well, okay, here's where the crime might have taken place. They filled out the form. They sent the form to this guy by fax. Then he had to do something with that form. I think that's where the crime probably took place. He had to submit that to a bank or something, correct?
I don't know.
Or
I've never stolen $8 million with one
form.
Well,
it's worth thinking about. We're talking about $8 million here, and if this guy was smart, he would be in some foreign country someplace, untouchable.
He needs our callers who would tell him to go to Cuba, one-way ticket.
Yeah, maybe. Bernie, what do you think? Did he have to do something with the piece of paper, or as soon as it was faxed to him, was it already...
No, it sounds like from everything I've read about this report, this was just very simple. In the email that he sent to Condé Nast, apparently he just specified that he is a company called QuadGraph, which sounds very similar to Quad/Graphics, which is apparently Condé Nast's actual printing company. And he provided his bank account information, like the account number and the routing.
And they can't even get him for stealing their name, because he didn't use the same name. He used some of the letters of the name, but he didn't actually use the name.
I'm sure the federal authorities will charge him with some sort of fraud. And it's also it's wire fraud whenever you use email or fax or ask that something be faxed to you, that's considered wire fraud. And there's other kinds of fraud.
Wait, you left out a condition there. You said anytime somebody requests to have something faxed, that's wire fraud. There obviously has to be more to it than that. Faxed with...
If there's fraudulent intent,
uh-huh.
And in this case, I think the prosecutors, federal prosecutors, will argue that this was an attempt to defraud Condé Nast out of money.
Or might it have just been an experiment to see if this is actually so simple that it could work?
I would think this would be better if you had the money sent to some charitable organization's bank account. You know, somebody that would make Condé Nast look really bad if they asked for the money back. So,
uh-huh.
Too bad that didn't happen.
Well, here's something else sort of related to that I've always kind of wondered. You know, when you're trying to get electronic payments started on a credit card or a phone company or something like that, they ask you to write your checking account number into a form, and they say, here, enter the routing code, enter this and that, and all the information is on your check. So that's what you look at. You look at your checking account and you put it all in there, and that's really all you have to do. There are many cases where I've simply given them that information, and then all of a sudden they start withdrawing directly from my account. And I've heard cases where people simply enter a checking account number from, say, the phone company themselves or from some other, you know, person that has no suspicion this is going on. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of check of this kind of thing going on.
In my experience, that works for deposits. You can give your routing number to anyone, your routing and your account number to anyone, but you ought not to be able to withdraw with that same information. So anybody can put money into your account, and that's the convenience of the routing number and your account, your checking account number, but they ought not to be able to withdraw without authorization, and you might have to sign or provide some physical thing like a check written to someone.
See, I don't actually remember that kind of authorization coming through. I remember putting in the information, and maybe they take money out or uh-huh. ask you for verification of a certain amount. I know they do that sometimes in the case of PayPal, but in most cases it just sort of starts. And I maybe this is something that has been updated since I did it, because I did this several years ago. But I was struck with how easy it is to get that information in the first place and put it in there and start taking money out of someone else's account.
No, I think it is that easy.
Is it that easy? Yeah. All right, well, listeners, don't do that. But do look at whatever forms you might have to fill out and see if it might be that simple. And pretend, how about this, pretend that you're somebody who doesn't agree to this and do it to yourself and see if money starts getting taken out of your account, and report back to us, oth@2600.com. How's that?
Seems complicated.
Yeah. Kyle, we've been working on a lot of projects over the last couple of weeks involving archiving, involving disk space, and this got me thinking.
Yes.
What is a word that we've probably been using quite a lot in the last a word we can say over the radio, insofar as disk sizes.
Terabyte.
Terabyte. That's very good. Terabyte.
Terabyte.
And it got me thinking. Let's look into the past a little bit. We have old computers that we're trying to summon up from the grave. One of those old computers, which in fact is a Zenith Z100, if anyone has one of those out there, you'll know the magic of that machine, has a 40 megabyte hard drive on it, which was considered huge at the time, 40
right.
megabytes. And in fact, when you got the machine, which was actually a Heathkit H100, you built it, it became a Zenith Z100,
mm-hmm.
It came with two floppies. So there was no hard drive. So adding the 40 megabyte hard drive really
right.
put you in the fast lane.
That's like a modification or like an aftermarket thing, right?
Because mm-hmm.
you're, you know, crafty or, you know, an enthusiast. So that only the real enthusiast would add that feature or something like that.
But, right.
So
basically, 40 megabytes. A megabyte is 1,024 kilobytes.
Right.
So we would measure things before that in K. In kilobytes. So I remember 100K floppy drives, floppy disks, that is, to put in those drives.
Okay.
And people would write programs based on how much you could save, how succinct you could get it all into, so it would fit onto limited space. So you had kilobytes, and kilobytes, of course, are 1,024 bytes, and a byte is 8 bits, but let's not go there. Let's go in the other direction.
It does get complicated.
It gets complicated.
Bits and bytes.
It does. And I we could spend hours talking
sure.
about that. And
continue.
I'd rather not. So we have megabytes. And then the step beyond megabytes is, of course, Anyone?
Gigabyte.
What was that? What's gigabyte. That about to speak up?
Gigabyte.
Gigabytes, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, yes, you're right. Gigabytes. Gigabyte is 1,024 megabytes. And then what we just mentioned, terabytes, that's 1,024 gigabytes. Okay. Who wants to say what comes next?
Peta.
Excuse me?
Peta.
Peta what?
Bytes.
Petabytes. Okay. A petabyte, you're right. P-E-T-A-B-Y-T-E. Actually, they say here it's 1,048,576 gigabytes is a petabyte. Now,
that's 1024 times 1024.
Now, why is that? Why isn't it 1,024
gigabytes?
Terabytes.
Oh, wait.
Oh, it is. It
oh,
is.
You know what? They stopped listing. So it's 1,024 terabytes. Okay. Yeah, they just started doing everything by gigabytes. Okay. That's what we're going to be dealing with next. We have what's the standard these days when you buy a hard drive? It's a terabyte, 2 terabytes.
Depends which one you buy.
Well, yeah, but what's common?
I would argue that computers generally come with like 230 or like maybe a 500 gig hard drive.
Okay.
Like out of a store off the shelf, usually that's around what you get. Maybe more now.
But a terabyte drive is pretty common. 1.5 terabytes.
Yeah,
they're readily available. 2 terabyte drives. I think if you're trying to build a large storage array, you'd build it out of 2 terabyte drives.
So, and the reason I'm going over this because people listen to our show in the future, and they listen to our shows from the past. I just think this will be very interesting to listen to a few years down the road, where we're talking about this, and we're talking about terabytes being the next big thing. But petabytes is going to come after that, and soon we'll have petabyte drives. And
the Internet Archive will sell you a petabox.
Really?
Which is not really true, because a whole bunch of machines that add up to a petabyte, but still.
Okay. All right. Well, that's handy information to have. Okay. Who wants to give a guess as to what comes after petabyte? And Bernie, I can't say for sure you're not on the Internet, so I'm not sure I'm going to let you guess.
I'm not going to cheat, and I don't know either.
Okay, well, that's honest then.
It's
anybody?
It's an exabyte.
Kind of wise guy over there. Exabyte. Okay, you've already looked into this.
You need storage. You need to plan for the future, Emmanuel.
An exabyte. Yeah, 1,024.
Try fitting that in your desk drawer.
Petabytes. Well, yeah, that's true. All right, you got me there. Okay, well then, you want to say what comes after that?
Too much.
Okay, so that's where your knowledge runs out then.
Yettabyte.
A what?
Yettabyte.
No, but that's a good guess. It's actually a zettabyte.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this?
No. My memory is getting refreshed here thinking about this. I was going to say an oobyte.
An oobyte?
But that's so wrong. It's XO then zeta. Is
okay.
It zeta with a T or zeta with a D?
It's a zeta with a T.
T.
But starting with a Z.
Obviously starting with a Z. How would a Zeta start with a T?
I don't know.
Zettabyte.
Yeah,
maybe they'll be doing that in the future.
Okay. Voltaire, what was your guess again?
Yettabyte.
Well, if you look at 1,024 zettabytes, it's actually a yottabyte. Not Yoda Star Wars Yoda. Yota. Y-O-T-T-A.
Yottabyte.
And that's, that's 1 septillion bytes, I believe.
We shouldn't even address the whole controversy over steps of 1,000 versus 1,024.
No, I think we can skip over that.
All right.
But just to give you a sense as to what all this means, basically a bit is a binary decision. We mentioned a bit before, but let's go to a byte. One byte is one character. All right, 5 megabytes, that's the complete works of William Shakespeare.
Depends how you store it.
Well,
if you print out the pages and scan them in as images, they'll be a lot bigger.
Stored as text. Stored as characters, the original ASCII characters.
But
a lot of characters in Shakespeare.
He had italics.
Oh, very good, yes.
You need italics.
Well, you can represent italics in different ways. And all right, fine. 6 megabytes I'll give you then. But pretty much the entire works of Shakespeare will fit there. Now, 2 gigabytes is 20 meters of shelved books. 20 meters. Have we ever seen 20 meters of shelved books?
It's not that much if you stack them on top of each other rather than one big 20-meter shelf.
I suppose, but it's more than we'd have in our homes.
It's more, yeah, but a library has got more than that.
All right, 10 terabytes. What do you think could fit on 10 terabytes? Well, we don't know.
About 10 terabytes worth of data.
Bernie, you want to give a guess on this?
I'll guess all the books in the Library of Congress.
How did you know that? That's exactly it.
Man.
Wow.
It was a guess. It really was a guess.
That's a good guess. That might be the best guess ever on this program. Yeah, the entire collection of the U.S. Library of Congress will fit on 10 terabytes.
Wait, but stored as text?
You had this text thing.
Well, no, a lot of the works in the Library of Congress, first of all, they have music and video recordings there, but also they have images.
We said printed. Printed collection.
But many books have images in them, and you need to store those as well or you're losing data.
Maybe there's a way to do that in 10 terabytes, or maybe you need another terabyte or two. I don't know. You can compress it. I'm sure you can get it onto 10 terabytes. We can make it a project if you want.
All right.
But let's move on to 200 petabytes. This is something nobody has yet. At least nobody we know. What do you think fits on that? Anyone want to guess?
The entire compendium of human knowledge?
I was going to say that.
Maybe your entire compendium, but all printed material.
I was going to say everything ever published.
I don't know what that means. Does that mean a wrapper of a Snickers bar or something? Or it could be...
Every wrapper of every Snickers bar?
Yeah. And this is the best one. 5 exabytes. And remember, these are exabytes. 5 exabytes. We went on to zettabytes and yottabytes beyond that, but 5 exabytes. All words ever spoken by human beings. Yeah. Now, I don't know if that means audio. I don't know if that means just a list of every word. I don't know if that means every single conversation ever spoken or just a list of all the words.
Does it include the plans for the time machine to go back and give the recorders to prehistoric people?
I don't know. I'm not sure. A lot of this is missing. A lot of this information is just not here. But there is information on the yottabyte, the last one that we touched upon. It's basically a unit of information of computer storage equal to 1 septillion bytes. As of 2011, this year, no storage system has achieved 1 zettabyte of information. 1 zettabyte of information. We're talking about yottabytes. The combined space of all computer hard drives in the world does not amount to even 1 yottabyte. But was estimated at approximately 160 exabytes in 2006. As of 2009, the entire internet was estimated to contain close to 500 exabytes.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's a good reaction to that. I'm pretty shocked myself. Yobabyte. Using a binary prefix is used for the corresponding power of 1024.
Let's not go there. But who provided this chart?
That was from Wikipedia.
All right, I'm gonna edit it.
Yeah,
it'll say all kinds of things.
Go
next.
Ahead. Yes, do your worst, Bernie. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say that we don't know for sure that a storage system does not exist that can store a yottabyte. Some of the intelligence agencies, most noteworthy the National Security Agency, has for many decades. Had just incredibly humongous storage facilities because they archive just ginormous amounts of data, voice, data, imagery. They're amazing vacuum cleaners of all kinds of stuff. It would not surprise me if they have storage capacities in that quantity. We just don't know about it because it's classified. It was a blast from the past when you said exabyte, too, because exabyte was the name of a company. Sometimes in the late 70s or early 80s, a company called Exabyte, they made a device called a stringy floppy. Do you remember that? It was a peripheral for TRS-80s and I think for Apple IIs. It was like a cassette tape, only it was smaller, and it was like a linear tape drive instead of diskettes. It stored like 100K or something. It was called the Exabyte stringy floppy, but only stored like 100K.
I definitely don't remember anything being called a stringy floppy. That's something that... That is alien to me. But
that's a terrible name.
It is, and it's probably why it's not around today.
Probably.
Wow. Okay. That's something to learn. Now, as far as this week's accusation against hackers. Oh, by the way, there's that new show premiering tonight about hackers breaking in on Fox. I think it comes on after our show because they know that they're not going to get any audience during our show. Anybody care to watch this? Anybody think anything of it? Do we want to prejudge it? Or maybe we've seen episodes already somehow through pirated downloading sites or something?
You know, I've done a lot for the show over the years, but watching a Christian Slater evening drama is where I draw the line, dude. I'm sorry.
Christian Slater is in this?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, some people say it's starring Christian Slater, but really I have to ask about the ability of anything to actually star Christian Slater.
Okay, well, you two have issues, obviously, so I'm not going to probe deeper into that, but... I think the premise is about somebody who gets hired by some kind of target team in a company that he goes through all sorts of
antics.
Was
this the thing that there was a preview floating around a few months ago?
Was there a preview?
It looked terrible.
Yeah. It's basically Sneakers the series, I think, in all but name.
Yes. Oh, well, Sneakers wasn't a bad film.
It wasn't a bad film as such, but there was no Christian Slater in it.
What is it with Christian Slater? Okay, fine. I guess we'll judge it after it airs, which is tonight.
Does this mean we have to watch it? Because I'm not that interested.
Well, I don't know if you can judge things without seeing them. Maybe
I do
you
it
can
all
do
the
that.
Time.
Oh, yeah, I guess. But well, our listeners, I'm sure, will tell us what they think about it. All kinds of plot holes you could drive trucks through. Except on the FDR drive tonight. Don't try that. A hacker was accused of wiping out an entire season of a TV show. The producer of the syndicated children's TV series Zodiac Island claims that... Oh, we're all familiar with that. Wow, everyone's eyes lit up. claims that, even Mike's, an entire season of the show has been wiped out thanks to a fired employee at its data hosting company who hacked into network computers and destroyed its work. Zodiac Island has run on more than 100 U.S. TV stations around the country, including ABC, NBC, Fox, and CBS affiliates. Well, I don't understand why they have to mention what affiliates they are. Obviously, it's a syndicated show that can air on any station. So, yeah, some of them are ABC, NBC, Fox, and CBS. It's got nothing to do with the network. The show is produced by Hawaii-based WER1 World Network, which signed up with Wisconsin-based ISP and data hosting company CyberLink. According to a lawsuit that was filed last week in Hawaii District Court, a man named Michael Scott Jusen was terminated from CyberLink. From his parents' residence, he allegedly accessed CyberLink's data and intentionally wiped it out. He is alleged to have been charged in February with a federal computer crime violation and admitted his guilt in a plea agreement. The data breach allegedly knocked out 6,480 electronic files, or 300 gigabytes of data. Now, do you remember what we can store on 300 gigabytes? Apparently, it can store an entire season of the TV
about
show.
One television show season is what I was going
to
say.
Well, what I don't understand is why don't they simply appeal to people who must have taped the show? June's who's driving in right now, I'm sure he has it on tapes or on TiVo somewhere.
I think they hadn't aired it yet, is the thing.
Oh, they haven't aired it yet?
It was the upcoming season did was they, the impression I got.
Did they really not have any other copies except there? I mean, how dumb can you possibly be? This is what I mean when I say that you can never have a substitute for something in hard copy, and you have to keep backups of every single drive that you own.
Yeah, and any admin will tell you, never have your only copy of anything on a networked computer. You always have something offline, something offsite. I mean, you could walk into a store right now with $30 and get a hard drive that could have saved them all this trouble.
And also, while we're at it, why is it that a disgruntled employee instantly becomes a hacker as soon as he arrives? Is something. What is it there? I mean, you know, somebody takes out their office with a rifle. They're not just suddenly referred to as a hunter. They're referred to as a maniac, somebody who, and you can use similar words for somebody who does something like this. There's no hacking ability involved in logging in and erasing something.
I think this is much less dangerous than shooting people in an office.
Well, some people would disagree with that. This is a TV show. This is a whole season of a TV show. People
What's the name of it again? Don't look at the paper.
It's Fantasy Island or something. I don't know. The name is not important. But the thing is, I'll never know the name now because all records of his existence have been wiped away. Yeah. Into the memory hole. What's that?
At least for this season.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, pretty shocking. And then we also have the story of .gov sites, and we should focus on some of these while we have the chance with our .gov of the week. We haven't done in quite some time because we've been so busy with other things. But many of the Obama administration's top open government initiatives are set to be turned off by the end of May. Government sources confirm that the Office of Management and Budget is planning to take 7 websites dark in 2 months because of a lack of funding. I'm sure there's people around here that will volunteer to run these websites. A government official who demanded anonymity because they didn't get any permission to discuss the topic but decided to go ahead and do so anyway, said funding will begin to run out on April 20th for public sites IT-Dashboard, Data.gov, and PaymentAccuracy.gov. They also said that OMB is planning on shutting down internal government sites, including Performance.gov, FedSpace, and many of the efforts related to the FedRAMP cloud computing cybersecurity effort. The official said 2 other sites, USAspending.gov and apps.gov/now, will run through July 30th but go dark soon after. We need at least another $4 million just to keep USAspending.gov operating this year. We're looking at a pass-the-hat approach, but it could be challenging to get that done in time, they say. Wow. they
is
really...
this an April Fool's story?
No, it's not. It came out April 4th.
We need $4 million to run USAspending.gov. That's got to be an April Fool's story.
It's an April 4th joke. That's. I don't get what all the money is for, but that's what they have to do. Bernie, any ideas on how to save these .gov websites?
Well, I think the federal government needs to look at its spending priorities. Supposedly, some of these sites end up saving, you know, an order of magnitude more money to the government than they cost to run. But, you know, it doesn't look like what's going on in Congress right now is right-headed. So they're just going to cut everything they can, and it's going to end up costing us more in the end, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sad but true. So that's a story there as far as that goes. Checking to see if we have listener mail this week. I know we do. We always have bits of mail that people send in to oth@2600.com. But I'm looking at last week's mail. Let me give out the phone number, 212-209-2900. And we'll be taking phone calls in just a little bit. But another fun bit of news involving British Petroleum, BP. A BP employee has lost a laptop containing personal data belonging to thousands of Louisiana residents who just so happened to file claims for compensation after the Gulf oil spill. What an unfortunate accident that is. You file for compensation and your public information somehow gets out. Must be hackers, right? The firm said it had sent letters to roughly 13,000 people whose data was stored on the computer, notifying them about the potential security breach and offering to pay for their credit to be monitored. I'll bet for 1 year, right? They get 1 year credit monitoring out of this deal, just like they always do when they leave your information lying around. The laptop was password protected, but the information was not encrypted. Data included a spreadsheet of claimants' names, social security numbers, phone numbers, and addresses. Curtis Thomas, a BP spokesman, said the company did not have any evidence that claimants' personal information had been misused. Of course, how would you have that information? How would you ever get it until it actually happens? And maybe not even then.
I'd like to issue an appeal to our listeners. Some of them must have been the victims of one of these breaches by now and got their year of credit monitoring. I want to know, did this credit monitoring, like any case of it actually finding something?
Or maybe you have the laptop too, in which case you could tell us how easy it was to crack.
That'd be cool.
I bet the password was BP or something like that.
Emmanuel?
Yes, go ahead, Bernie.
I just want to point out this 1 year of credit monitoring that these companies who expose all your private information to unauthorized third parties, I think it's really a ripoff. I think you should get lifetime credit monitoring where any of the three major consumer reporting agencies have to tell you if your credit file has changed. Because, you know, if I were a criminal and I stole all this information, I would just wait it out just 1 year. You know, all these people's names and social security numbers and addresses aren't going to change in a year. You wait till the year has passed, and then you go crazy with it and use it, and so the people who are victims aren't going to get notified. So I just think the 1 year thing is really lame, and it should be the rest of your life.
Well, yeah, okay, for what it's worth, but I really wish they'd stop losing all this information and keeping people's private information out of the public eye.
And once again, you have an organization of this size claiming to only have one copy of something, and that copy got lost. I mean, that is completely ludicrous for anything like that. They're either really stupid or they're lying.
No, they must have another copy because they sent letters.
Ah, okay.
It's just another instance of how people plan for things and they think that it's always going to be there. They're always going to have access to this information, and they lose the password, they lose the disk, something doesn't work right after an upgrade, and they're screwed. And it happens so many times. And you can avoid it by simply keeping backups and keeping track of your information, your files, whatnot. Okay, 212-209-2900 is our phone number. A couple of letters that we've gotten. I heard you guys talking about emails that are anonymous, how they should be accepted. So if I sent an anonymous email to a company or a department within the company, will it not even get read? Signed, Ashish. I don't think it's true that anonymous email sent to a company simply won't be read by default. Depends what you say. They might not respond. They might not take it seriously. But I do think that that anonymous mail will get read. Anonymous mail to us gets read. So if there's somebody reading mail, I don't think they really care if it's a pseudonym or no name at all. They should read it. Whether they do anything with it, that's a whole other issue. Anybody have other feelings on this?
Depending on the anonymity method you use, you may or may not be able to hear back from them. They might have the ability to reply, they might not. So,
okay, here's another letter. I'm a big fan of the show. I've been listening to the show since 1998 when I was in high school, off and on. I'm 28 now, and I'm still a big fan of the show. I was just wondering a couple of things. I'm looking through the archives. When does Rebel appear on the show for the first time? Well, Rebel almost always appears as our first caller, and he has started doing this, I think, at the beginning of the 90s. You have to look back in the archives. I don't know why you'd want to, but type the word Rebel into the search bar on 2600.com, and it should pull up maybe the first show he called into. But yeah, that kind of thing can happen. Number two, is there an archive to hear old automated systems from around the country? I live in Connecticut, the old Southern New England telephone area. Rob, you might know something about this.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually has a website called thisisarecording.com, and it's just an archive of old telephone company recordings of all sorts from all points in history. So there's a lot of good stuff there.
All right, there you go. And if you have access to information like this, this is something that we like to do. We like to put recordings up on the net. But people out there have recordings of old phone calls or recordings of things like that. By all means, post it someplace. Make a website for it. It's history. And number three, what about the Go to Cuba guy? What's up with that guy? Signed, Aubrey, we don't know. We have no idea what's up, but we have the best minds at the station trying to figure it out. And one more letter from Robert in Ohio. Didn't you have a subscription up for the Nook at one point? I bought the previously released edition in the Barnes & Noble store on the Nook. Was this not supposed to be there? Maybe I missed something that you said. Yeah, Robert, it's a little complicated. First of all, an update to last week. We were talking about how the Kindle version of 2600 was suddenly no longer available for Android applications, and that Amazon was saying that this was something that we did. And it was something they did. We've gotten them to fix it. We've gotten them to apologize for it, to contact people that were complaining about it. And that is no longer an issue. But it's one of a bunch of issues, the biggest being the whole iPad controversy. We're committed to getting this thing onto the iPad by the next issue, one way or another. It's tricky because when you're dealing with different companies, they're sort of competing with each other. And if you give too much of a favorable deal to one company, then the other company doesn't want to do business with you anymore. The way it works is Amazon demands to have the lowest price for the Kindle. We could offer it on the Nook, but they might set it to be a lower price, and we have no control over the price that they set. If they do that, then half of what Amazon would pay us is taken by Amazon. It's incredibly silly. But one thing that we want to do is let people know every step of the way what it is that we're working on. We're also working on volume 27, which is 2010 issues, putting them on our store, putting them out in PDF format and Kindle format, Nook format, everything like that. Our goal is to get everything into every format. It takes work. It takes time. It's a hassle, but it's also a learning experience, and it's something that that we're doing with our listeners.
I think calling the process silly doesn't really give them enough credit for the amount of intentional monopolistic tendencies that they have.
Yeah, I'm trying to be nice, and I definitely don't like the business practices here. It's anti-competitive, and it's something that shuts a lot of people out. But I figure, you know, if we use their technology to tell people about it, then it'll educate a lot more people, maybe make some changes. All right, we're almost out of time, so let's try and take some phone calls. 212-209-2900. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello. I suppose in lieu of watching the Breaking In show, although I'm sure they'll throw in many wonderful computer jokes, I would recommend Level 9 and or Max Headroom.
Is that on tonight?
You can be on whenever you want.
Okay, true.
Also for the Zodiac Island, which sounds like a, you know, serial killer survivor show.
But, right.
If the studio is in Hawaii, why would they have their data backup in Wisconsin?
Probably because things are cheaper in the Midwest. Who knows? I don't know why data would be cheaper in the Midwest, but it's probably there are servers in Texas that that feed companies in other parts of the world.
Texas makes sense because they have no environmental regulations, so they can just get cheap electricity by emitting lots of pollutants.
There you go. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up. Well, he didn't speak up fast enough, Rebel. Rebel was number two that time. As you can see, he's slipping over the years. Good evening.
Hi.
You're on Off the Hook.
Hi, how are you?
What's on your mind?
All right. Here's the eerie thing about that letter you wrote about those records. I got something about 4 weeks ago from my hospital, my borough, where I was treated at one time. And the letter sounded almost the same, except to say that the transporting car or truck got broken into, and they stole the discs. But it wasn't encrypted, exactly the same letter.
Interesting. Well, they have a boilerplate letter that's just ready for any kind of situation to happen, and it happens so often that they just they fire them off pretty quickly. They never seem to lose their list of email addresses, though, of victims of their or customers, as they call them. One more call, then we're out of here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yes.
No, Rebel, you've used up more time on this show than we have somehow. I don't know how you did it, but you did. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Good evening. How are you?
What's on your mind?
I was wondering, I know how to submit stuff, articles to the magazine, but what's the best way to submit artwork?
You can actually send it to articles at 2600.com. It'll get to the right people that way. Okay. And yes, yeah, send graphics, pictures, whatever that you might have. That's the best way to do it. And you could also send it through the mail as well to P.O. Box 99, Middle Island, New York, 11953, USA.
Oh, cool. I did do that.
All right, good.
All right.
Look forward to seeing it. Thanks.
Okay,
thanks for your call. Thanks for participation. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Sorry about the late start or the crazy drive in. We'll see you next week. Good night.
This is 99.5 New York WBAI. I'm Howard here with Joe,
Hank,
the personal computer show, and Steve.
Today's topic is the computer show.
Today's date. And welcome to the Personal Computer Show. You want to take down the theme there, young man, and okay, folks, we're having a little bit of fun here because Howard is new to the board, new to the show, new to the station. Stevie DB is training him, and Howard has no idea how bad Stevie really is, and he's trying his best to emulate him.
He's doing a great job.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is Joe King. Hank Key is with me in the studio. And do we have the West Coast on the telephone?
No, I don't think so.
Do we have the West Coast?
No, not yet. No, but by the way, Joe, you heard one of the big stories last week, and that's the fact that Google has picked Kansas City, Kansas, to install their 1 gigabyte network.
Is that different from Kansas City, Missouri?
Yes, it is. It's a different city. Kansas City, Kansas.
It's right across the
river.
The
metropolitan area is about 500,000 people. That's a 500,000. And I think it's through fiber and all other gizmos they're going to use. They will be offering 1 gigabyte per second service.
No, gigabit per second.
I'm sorry, gigabit per second. And the question is...
what's the difference between a gigabyte and a gigabit?
Well, it's very easy. A byte and a bit, the difference is 8 to 1. So it's an 8 to 1 ratio.
That's okay? Very fast.
Right? Now, what they're talking about is a very fast service. The only question that we have not been able to find out is how much?
How much what?
It's going to cost the subscribers.
Oh, well, they haven't built it yet, so how do they know what it's going to cost?
Well, the thing is, they're hoping to have it operational by the end of next year, which is pretty quick. And I guess the big question, Joe, is that when they get it operational, would it be predatory and they're going to wipe out all the ISPs local to that area?
No, that's not the point of it. The point of it is to run a test so that this is considerably faster than the national effort.
Much faster.
The national effort came out with an effort to wire the country, and in essence make the entire country available to the to a wireless setup. And this is a test to show that it can be done at a gigabit level as opposed to a multi-megabit level.
Well, the only question I have is Google's been subject of many topics about whether or not they're predatory, whether it's they have a monopoly and
have
so
you ever
on.
Noticed that anytime somebody does something good, they're predatory?
Now, wait a minute. When you say something good, let me see the price on it, and then I'll tell
you.
No.
What's good here is the technology. On the West Coast, we have somebody who knows a little bit about technology, not a lot, because.
But
I want to bring in David Perry, who is the dope at Trend. That's the director of public education,
well,
GOPD.
Dave, let me ask you a question. You've been around all over the world. Anyone offering 1 gigabit yet? Dave, are you?
Only in Norway. Only in Norway.
And have you been on the system when you're in Norway?
I have, and it was, you know, there's no place to go that's going to serve you anything fast enough to take advantage of that.
Oh, that's not true. I've seen Hank type.
Well, you know, Google has also announced that they were going to set up their own television-like network with YouTube, offering.
Right, that's just what we need.
They announced today that they will be offering specialty subjects by channels, and it'll be available on YouTube. And that's going to be you mean they're in the broadcasting business too?
Well, YouTube is in a way is narrowcasting. Now that you're gigabit, you can take narrowcasting to broadcasting. There's no big deal there. Hank, let's go on to our next story.
Well, the big news, okay, is something what I got in the mail, something that Joe got in the mail. Like, I got it from Verizon. Joe, you got it from a bank. And that's the fact that Epsilon is the world's largest email marketing service with over 40 billion emails a year. And they have a database client, a client database for 2,500 clients. It's a huge database.
They have 7 of the Fortune top 10 companies.
And it's been compromised.
Tell us about it, David.
Well, you're asking me because I'm the dope, right?
That's correct.
This was a targeted attack. Now, this is a targeted attack is a term you're going to hear a lot of in coming months, because the bad guys who were going out, you know, shotgun and attacking every email address in the world are now figuring out that they can go to a service like this one and steal the information for 100 million people in a single swipe. So they went in and attacked that place somehow, and we don't know how. It could have been the malware that got them in. It could have been an insider. It could have been an accident. We don't know. But they made off with an awful lot of data, and as a result of this, you have to watch out. You have to watch out because you could be getting email from your bank that's not really from your bank.
Well, what my bank indicated, and this was Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, and they indicated right. that all that was taken out was name and email address.
Now, this is BAI, so I can say what I really think, as long as it doesn't violate the...
As long as you don't violate the FCC rules and those seven famous words.
And also you don't libel anyone that you can't prove.
And also we have a strict rule that you don't tell them how to do it properly.
All right, poppycock. They stole plenty of stuff. They also know who you're doing business with, for example.
That's
just right on the surface, okay? So they know your name, your email address, and who you're doing business with, what bank you bank with, what hotel you stay in, what airline you fly, whatever was compromised.
Oh, you say they got the whole billing cycle, whereas what Trace said was they only got the name and address.
Well, name and address, and of course, what email it's attached to.
Well, you know, when
it
you
tells
say...
you where you do business, but you know what? I don't think so. I think that more was stolen than that. We will wait and see.
Okay, now what should the average person do? All right, we don't know how much was really taken. We only know what we were told. What should the average person do?
Well, the average person has to be informed that this is not a one-shot deal, that this information is out of the barn and will likely be utilized. Not, it hasn't been used yet. Nobody's done anything with this data yet, okay, because the whole world is looking for it right now. Look out in a year. Or 2 years, or 5 years. This is from now on. That data is compromised.
Well,
and
let me ask you.
It can be correlated with other data about you. So
exactly.
Here's what they're doing. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly what is compromised? Just your email address or your actual home address, too?
Your home name, your email address, and I would say potentially a lot more as well, like who you do business with.
Because one of the things that they have said to is that the College Board, you know, the testing service, they administer the SAT admission test. They're warning
yes.
students about the breach and ask them to be cautious about receiving links or attachments from third parties.
And this is the least imaginative place you can go with this. They're saying, well, look out for receiving links. Okay, always look out for receiving links and attachments from third parties. In fact, never click on a link in an unsolicited email that you don't know who it's from, ever. Not ever.
Well, I was told by J.P. Morgan Chase that they never, and they underlined the word never, never ask for any confidential information like passwords or account numbers or anything like that through an email. And if we get an email that's asking us to enter that kind of information, we should assume that it is a phishing attack.
Again, phishing attacks are obvious here, but there's more subtle things that they could do. You know that you can plant, something could be planted on you just from your opening an email. Suppose someone writes a little tiny Trojan that all it does is steal Chase Manhattan passwords, nothing else. And then they attach it to email and send it out to all the Chase Manhattan customers whose addresses they got off of the Epsilon hack.
Excuse me.
By the way, Epsilon
No, excuse me,
like
Dave,
something...
David, I got to ask you a question.
Yeah.
How old are you that you use the name Chase Manhattan?
I'm 57 years old. I'm 56.
And when did they
57.
Stop calling it Chase Manhattan?
When it was merged
Citibank
with...
Citibank now?
No. Chase Manhattan Bank merged with Chemical Bank, and they decided to call it Chemical Chase Bank. And then when they merged with J.P. Morgan, it became J.P. Morgan Chase because of the international reputation.
And when was
But the surviving company is really Chemical Bank.
And except the corporate name is J.P. Morgan.
Right. And it just all happened in the late 80s, early 90s.
And as far as Chase Manhattan goes, that was the early 80s.
No, that was in the late 80s that happened.
Late 80s it went away? Okay, so that was 20-odd years ago.
Wait, but here's, okay, two things. First, I love the name. They're calling this the Epsilon Breach. That sounds like something you send Scotty down to the engine room.
Yes.
Okay, and B, basically what this does is now, if you weren't aware of this before, you're aware of it now, email is not trustworthy. There's no simple instructions I could give you, and I know what I'm talking about here, that would make you safe in this regard. Email is not trustworthy.
No, if you follow my instructions on using your computer, and that includes you, Hank, and Howard, and all of you folks, my instructions will protect you totally. The first thing you do when you open up your computer is disconnect it from the net, totally. Then you remove all floppy disk or external disk, optical disks, and seal those ports up. Then you have a safe computer.
And then you put it in a box and ship it back to the manufacturer.
Yeah, that would be better.
David, I have a question for you. What liability?